Ahoy, authors! You're listening to the Writership Podcast, a show focused on helping indie authors master self-editing skills. So come aboard and get ready to find the treasure in your manuscript with hosts Leslie Watts and Clark Chamberlain.
Welcome to episode 87 of the Writership Podcast. I'm Leslie Watts, here with Clark Chamberlain from the Book Editor Show. Every week, we show you editing in action with tips that you can use to improve your own stories. If you want to learn more about the Writership Podcast, you can visit the website at writership.com/podcast.
And as you know, the Writership Podcast is brought to you by the good folks at Author Marketing Club, home of the new and improved Amazon Reviewer Grabber tool. You know you need high-quality reviews for your books, so you should use the AMC Reviewer Grabber tool to quickly and easily locate reviewers that are ready, willing, and able to review your books for you. Become a premium member of AMC now by visiting www.authormarketingclub.com and get instant access to this tool and more. Leslie, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Clark. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well in frozen north, you know.
I'm in the almost frozen south.
Yeah, we were talking off air about comparing temperatures. So,
yeah, I should let you go first when we talk about how cold it is.
So that way, then you can drop your numbers lower, so you can be. a little closer.
It really is cold.
But that's what happens, you know. You get close to this time of year, December, Christmas season's upon us, you know, all that holiday fun.
Yes, in the Northern Hemisphere, right? Mm-hmm. It's absolutely. Yeah, it seems odd to me that, like, to have that, you know, people in the Southern Hemisphere have Christmas time and Hanukkah and such in the summer. Anyway,
you were telling me that you have a little problem with your Christmas tree.
I had a little problem with my Christmas tree, yes, because the cats, which they're still young, they're like 7 months old, and they thought that it was basically playground equipment for them. And so they were climbing up in it and launching themselves from it. And with all the crazy antics, I'm thinking about maybe having a series with them, you know, where Captain Grimm and Lady Gwen go on adventures and stuff. Climbing trees.
Are they batting out like the ornaments and things like that? Are they?
Yeah.
Toss. Oh, fun. Yeah. That's fun.
it's good stuff.
Mm-hmm. I'm just so happy for you.
Thanks. I was a little worried the other night that it might fall down, that the actual tree might, you know, just topple over. But we've shored it up, so I think we'll be okay.
Oh, that's good. Put a little scratching post on the inside of the tree, wrap that around.
Yep.
If you can't beat them, just join them.
Right, exactly. Oh, well, enough of the kitty shenanigans. Do you have a quote for us this week?
I do, from Beth Hill. And Beth says, "Transitions are important in fiction because the writer can't possibly portray or account for every moment in the character's day, week, or life. A story may stretch over years. Readers don't need to know what happened every minute of those years. So we use scene transitions to skip periods of time or to change to a new location in the story, glossing over events that happen between the new and the old times or locations."
All right. So it's you know, what's funny is that what came to me out of that was a story in which you did, like, tell every event, you know. In someone's life for a period of time, it would be an interesting exercise, but probably not that riveting a read.
No, it wouldn't be so riveting, especially if it's a whole life. This last summer, I did a developmental edit for a guy, and the event took place over about a 12-hour period, and it stayed full scene for the entire 12 hours. And yeah, it's pretty bad.
That's
when you have like awkward conversations going on, or going to get a drink of water, or using the bathroom, and all this type of stuff, and never leaving that scene, and you can feel how that just changes your desire to keep reading. Because the story,
not to put too fine a point on it.
Right, exactly. We had that talk for a long time about changing things up a bit and taking it over a few days period, perhaps, and so we could have some transitions and scene breaks, because it's important. Those are rest stops. Those are moments to help the story have flow and rhythm and all of that type of pacing that needs to take place.
Mm-hmm.
To really feel like the story that you're trying to tell.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. All right. Well, I guess we should get to the submission.
Yeah.
So we have Ascendancy by A.B. Corley. This is a sword and sorcery novel. The word count was at 43,000, and this is the beginning of the book, and today I'm going to read for us, and I may get some of the pronunciation wrong. I'm doing my best with it. So here we go. Ascendancy. The grass felt soft under Malakan's feet. It proved silent underfoot as Malakan crawled forward, careful not to spook the hare that stood a few paces ahead of him. He didn't know what he would do, if he caught it, nor did he know how to do so. But that didn't stop his senses from overloading with giddiness at his own cunning, bubbling over his face like a cauldron with too much water. But as happy as he was, desperation was the prevailing sentiment. He had not eaten since the previous morning, and the gnawing hunger of a young, growing man tore at him constantly. The hare stood up, looked left, right, twitching his whiskers and ears. The grass was high, and it couldn't see over it, but its sense of sound was keen. With the guile of a master huntsman, Malakan threw himself on top of the hare. His heart shot up into his ears, pounding away like a great battle drum. As he flew through the air, he felt so alive, so happy, so proud of his cleverness. But the euphoria left him as quickly as it had arrived, as he flopped on the dirt, no hare to be seen. It had darted away even as the thought to leap crossed Malakan's mind. He rolled over and sighed. He had been stalking that hare for an hour at least, and it seemed he would go hungry. He looked up at the sky and lay there breathing in the sunlight. He was now the age of 13, which is the year of the Gott's rite of maturity. Tradition dictates that he wander and exist alone through all the days up to his 14th birthday, where, if he survived, he would be considered an adult. It was summer in Jotark, a time to be happy. Many birds came from lands far away, and the meadows, coasts, forests, and hills echoed with their calls, chirps, and songs. The sun burned through clouds like fire through dry grass, and it was always breezy, so you never got too hot. The seas warmed and the snows in the mountains melted. The grasslands and woodlands exploded with animal life. Deer, boar, rabbits, badgers, mice, squirrels, grouse, auroch, foxes, snakes, turtles, and countless others came alive with the rich bounty of grass, flowers, seeds, and game. Malakan hardly spent any time indoors during this time of year. He would pitch a camp out of sticks and boughs and just sleep under the stars. He would climb pine trees all day and run from village to village, challenging kids to all sorts of game. It was in this way that he met a young Got called Kalak, who will come to play a large part in our story. Kalak, a strong lad of 12 winters old, had a platinum blonde mane of hair down to his neck and amber eyes. He had a stronger build than almost anyone else his age on the island, and he did not hesitate to show off his strength at every chance he got. That day, it was Malakan who came to challenge him to contest, and he was more than happy to oblige. The sun shone brightly, wisps of clouds that streaked across the sky, but apart from those, it was blue and beautiful outside. Malakan had come to the village of Wad, which means forest, in the early afternoon. Kalak was standing outside, splitting logs, when Malakan strode up to him. "'Tis early in the season for such labor," said Malakan crassly. Kalak looked upon the stranger with young yet discerning eyes and took an immediate dislike of him, for Kalak could tell he was fit and capable, just as he was, as well as rude, to walk up to a stranger and say such things. The fool will do himself the worst harm when he allows himself to be caught unprepared. The wind was of gale force last night, and it may come again. When you are shivering in your bed at night, I will be warm until morning, said Kalak. He was well-spoken for his age, and reveled in the rebuke he just delivered to the stranger. "My good God, you cannot possibly fill your hearth until morning with such sloppy technique." Again, Kalak was puzzled at the arrogance of the stranger. "And I suppose you think you know how to do it better than I? Well, my dear stranger, on that front you will lose. No other young one on the island can match me for strength," boasted Kalak, adding emphasis by obliterating the log he had stood up. "Oh, but I speak not of your strength, for clearly you are without equal among our age. I speak of your stroke. It is all force and no grace or logic. When you swing over your shoulder like that, it takes away from your accuracy as well as your power. Let me demonstrate." Malakam grabbed the axe from Kalak, stood up a log, and sent it streaking over his head, splitting the log in two neat halves. Without pausing to gloat or explain his technique, he picked up one of the halves, set it on the block, and split it once again in two. Now he paused to speak his piece. "You see? Mine is clearly the superior swing," he said. Kalak did not like to be proved wrong, so he pushed Malakan out of the way and set up one the quarter cut blocks, which was now smaller around than a table leg. He ripped the axe from Malakan's hands and swung with all the might his body could muster. The axe hit the log somewhere in the side and sent it flying through the window of a nearby house. Malakan began to laugh. Kalak was furious at the result of this argument. His glowing amber eyes grew mad with rage, and he charged at Malakan, knocking him to the ground. Kalak was strong, but Malakan was cunning and swift. Kalak lacked the finesse to cover all of Malakan's escape routes, but Malakan lacked the strength to ever fully defeat his opponent. So in this way, they rolled around on the grass for a time until they were both too exhausted to continue. Eventually, They let go of each other and lay in the grass to recover. Malakun had never met an opponent he could not defeat, and Kallik had the same reputation. "Truly, you will be among the strongest of our kin when you come of age. Never have I met an opponent that could best me. I have traveled far in search of worthy contest, and at last, I have found one," said Malakun between breaths. Nothing could have surprised Kallik more than those words, paired with the sudden feeling of admiration he had for this young Gaut. "I may be strong, but you wriggled and fought out of every hold I brought to bear against you. I am named Kallik, son of Talik. What is your name?" asked Kallik between breaths. "I am named Malakun, son of General Kun, son of Hoter, son of Malakur, the Wind Child, seventh son in the line of Kun the Great," replied Malakun, with no small degree of pride. Kallik was silent and wide-eyed. He had heard stories of three of the five names that his opponent had just named. "That is a great claim. The house of Kun is filled with honor, and many a great warrior, adventurer, and mariner have come from that line. Is it true, though, you are the son of General Kun?" "Of course it is true. He is my father, and you have had the honor of competing against his son, Malakun. I am named for my father and my great-grandfather, for I have the likeness of both." Malakun could have gone on and on about the exploits of his ancestors for hours, but the point had been made. They stood up and brushed themselves off. "You were a very worthy opponent and come from a more than worthy house. It would be my honor if you would share supper with me," said Kallik. "I am on my right of maturity and have not eaten in a while. I will happily accept your offer." "I fear that I will have less to offer than what the heir of House Kun would normally be used to." "Fear not, my fine friend. I have spent many nights in the wilderness with little to eat but bread, berries, and whatever I can catch. The fare may be poor, but if the man is poor, then all is well, for he knows the value of having any food at all. And I haven't eaten since the morning before last." Okay, that's the end of our submission.
It was, I like that the author is trying the third omniscient. I think that was a lot of fun. And jumping into a style that's just not seen very much anymore.
Yeah, and I like the overall feel and mood of the piece that's very jovial and, you know, these just two young kind of happy men who are just kind of going about in the world doing their things, and they're not serious or worried or, you know, and they get into a tussle, of course, but it's all in good fun.
Yeah, you can really learn a lot of how to treat people in this book, you know, that even if you get, you know, you have your little disagreements and things like that. And I think it is actually kind of admirable, you know, and the one character commends him on being able to do to wrestle the way he did. And, you know, that even though it was a fight, then all of a sudden, you know, coming back and saying, "Wow, you're a worthy opponent." That's kind of a cool way to treat somebody. So that is actually kind of fun in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, instead of holding the grudge.
Right. Yeah. So some of the things that you know, we talked about before we started when we were looking at this is that that there's some issues with timing. That we've got in the beginning, we have this scene where Malakun is stalking the rabbit and then leaping to try to get it and misses. And then we hear about the summer, and then, you know, and then suddenly we're meeting Kallik, and we're not really sure about the distance. You know, he may have traveled, mm-hmm. or the time, you know, it could be that he just discovered him, you know, 20 minutes later or something, and that it's not that far away. But we don't really have a clue about that until at the very, you know, toward the very end, when he says that he hasn't eaten in a certain amount of time. And we had that that echo from the beginning.
Yeah. And one of the things that with the third omniscient that you're able to do here is you should have no problem doing transitions, because that narrator can just pop in and say, hey, now we're going over here. I want you to follow me, because we're going to, you know, see this part of the story. And so that you can use that, or you can use, you know, a regular where you just summarize, you know, in between those two parts, to move from one to the other. Where you really, it's not, since it is omniscient, we're not having a point of view change per se,
right.
But we are switching to a different character. And so it may just be as simple as having a double return so that we can see that there's something, a change in character shift is happening as well. Like, there's a lot of ways you can do it. You just have to pick the one that's going to work and then just be really clear about it, because we need to have that. Because for me, when I'm reading through this, it actually feels like a flashback. You know, he's talking about the seasons and how he plays outside, and or, you know, how the boy plays outside and what he does and all the animals and things. And so it feels like we've gone back to his childhood before 13, before he went on this manhood quest. But that's not what happened. You know, that's not the transition that's taking place there. So it's important to be clear on where you're taking the story.
Yeah. I think it's one of the things that I appreciate about the story grid, is that you know, you look at each scene and you assess the duration, so that you're actually touching that, you know, specifically looking at that for each scene, and then you'll be able to see across, you know, multiple scenes the amount, you know, the time that has passed and where you've gone from one place to another place and that kind of thing. Because when he talked about living, you know, he spent most of his time outside, or he spent almost no time inside, and while he's on his special his year of becoming a man, he's it sounds like he's not really living inside anyway, because he's you know, he's on his own and wandering. And so I think and all of this is, you know, the point of view when that changes, when that comes up, and different characters and different places and different times, that it's all about providing a smooth experience for the reader, so that they don't go, wait, what? Where are we? Because you want them to just disappear into that experience of the story rather than realizing that they're reading a book and having to jump around to confirm facts.
Yeah, because we don't have the benefit of a visual cues like we do in television or movies, where the scene changes and it's clear that the scene has changed and you're a different place, a different time. We don't have that here. And so that's why, you know, like being clear on your transitions, or even having, again, visual cue, like having a double return there, something that having the asterisks there centered between paragraphs where something has changed, just to let the reader know that a change has taken place, even if you're not explaining by putting the date and time and place written down there.
Right.
You know, when you change spots, you don't need to do that unless you want to. Mm-hmm. But something that allows the reader to easily say, yeah, I've moved, without it being obtrusive. Like, it's like the said as a dialogue tag. It becomes invisible.
Right.
But we know it's there.
Yeah. A week later, or mm-hmm. yeah, right. back at the ranch. Is that
back at the ranch?
Is that that's the saying? Yes, and I think you want to put it in the very, you know, right near the top, so that we are able to, you know, that we don't have to worry about it. Like, where are we, you know,
right.
and when are we in that? Yeah. So enough of that.
So you have a lot of choices, just, but you've got to pick one and then stick with it so that you train the reader.
Right. Right. You're just kind of, they can trust you. They can mm-hmm. fall into it and not have to be too diligent.
Yeah, exactly. One of the other big things that I came away with here is talking about the dialogue language. Now,
mm-hmm.
understand, I don't spend a ton of time reading big historical fiction where you use, you know, the actual language of the time and place. Mm-hmm. And this certainly makes me feel like we're in a different place, a different time. But just for me, because I'm not used to this, I still have a hard time visualizing 13-year-old boys speaking this way. Because it seems very, you know, like they're very proper. And mm-hmm. and they and it says that in there. You know,
right.
the with the one boy, which was it?
Malachan.
Yeah.
The heir to the great legacy. Uh-huh. That he...
Yeah.
He was well-spoken, I think, or something like that. It was noted that he is unusual in this, but they both were.
Yes, they both were. And that's the secondary part of this, is that that I would never be able to tell without a dialogue tag which boy was speaking, because they use too much the same words. They use the same sentence structures, you know, it's about the same length. So trying to come out with that unique voice was not apparent.
Yeah. I think, and it would be interesting to just, you know, to almost to take a scene and take out all of the dialogue from one boy and the dialogue from the other boy, and kind of have them side by side and looking at, you know, what can you tweak, what can you change, and what makes sense in light of the characters. You know, Malachan may be educated, or, you know, he may have had some extra schooling or something. Mm-hmm. It's not apparent to me whether that's the sort of thing, or if we're dealing with like Vikings where they're you know, where they, that wouldn't necessarily be part of it. But even within a Viking society where there's not official schools and that sort of thing, you would probably have different modes of speech between,
mm-hmm.
you know, Ragnar's son and then, you know, the fisherman or the, you know, the
yeah.
farmer.
And talking about that, like if you're going to have this distinct language, and let's say this is book one, a very distinct language happening, it might be good to set that up within your first, in your prologue chapter one, where we are with both children and adults, people of differing ages, and we can see how the sentence structures are working between these different groups. So we know that, yep, this is what 13-year-old boys talk like, because the adult talks twice as long and uses even bigger words or something like that, you
right.
know, so that we can see a difference. The other thing I had, another thought, like if you find yourself having your characters sound the same and you're not sure exactly what things to change, like one of the simple mechanics to change is like assign a total number of words that character can use in a sentence. So let's say Malik, he's the one who's well versed in everything, and like he always uses about 12 words in every sentence because he's eloquently speaks, uses a lot, he explains things. And maybe the other boy is from the country and he's very direct to the point, so he only uses 5 words in a sentence. And automatically you can start to see a difference between those characters when you're trying to come up with how to say this in 5 words.
Right. Yeah, for sure. It'd be kind of a fun exercise.
Yeah. It's one I sign. It's one that I use in my classes that I teach. You know, I was like, do this, try this out, see what happens.
Awesome. Yeah. So we talked also about the, and this is another aspect of the reader's experience and providing a smooth experience, is that we have, you know, we'll have a big block of description, and then we'll have a big block of dialogue, and, you know, and then some action, and that they're not truly woven together, so that we're focusing on one aspect and then focusing on another and then another, you know, in turns, in a way. And so much of it is really interesting and relevant and good, but to have them together, you know, the action while he's saying something, or him noticing something in his speech and describing it that way, or, you know, just that way of, and I'm trying to think of, how do you do that? It's one of those things it's kind of tricky. But just checking for the blocks first, like identifying it would be the first thing. But go ahead.
Yeah. Just imagine, especially when we're using omniscient, just imagine a narrator, like someone who's actually telling the story. Mm-hmm. And you're like, yeah. And, you know, as he crept closer to the rabbit, you could just see like the big smile that he was getting on his face, 'cause he was so excited about it. And he moved another inch closer, and then, you know, and then inside him, he was feeling like this. And then as he kept inching closer, and like, and it just adds this additional, feeling of, is he going to get the rabbit, and how his feelings are, mm-hmm. with the action that he's doing, and like getting more excited every moment he gets closer. And you can imagine that, like, you've been there with that really cool storyteller who does this, and he comes back and forth because he wants you to understand where you're at in the story in, mm-hmm. relationship to the action that's taking place between the boy and the rabbit. But he also wants you to know what the boy is feeling at the same time. And when you can see that those two things are woven together, it will pull you into it even more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm thinking of the section when he's describing all the wildlife and the, mm-hmm. and the grasses and flowers and such, and that there's, you know, that there is this, that, you know, a block there. And then we have the dialogue between them at the end, where they're not really doing anything while they're, you know, while they're talking, and they could be, mm-hmm. looking around or noticing things and shaking hands or whatever.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is like, this is your art. You get into the editing stage, this is your art, where you're being able to have the proportions right. You know, like, if you study like photography or painting, and you talk about like laws of thirds and the golden ratios, mm-hmm. this type of stuff, the same thing exists in storytelling, like how you move between different things. Like, you can't have an entire story that's just dialogue and act, you know, like dialogue. Like, it can't all be action. It can't be all narration. Like, you have to weave these things together to give the ultimate experience for your reader, that it's smooth and they can take away from it and feel good about it. Because especially like when you start getting into a page that's all dialogue back and forth, mm-hmm. that's, if you have ever gone to a website, you know, a blog article or something like that, you'll notice how it's written in a way that it's really easy to read, but then you'll notice that you skim it. And that's the same thing that happens. We've trained our people to do this, and now they come into here and it's all a big page full of dialogue, and they're going to skim right through that. And so, yeah. it's knowing how to move those things together to slow people down and make sure they notice stuff that's important.
Yeah. And especially with dialogue, it goes so fast because you don't always have an entire line, you know, it might be, mm-hmm. a few words or whatever in it. And there's a lot of, yeah, as you say, a lot of white space in it. It goes quickly.
Yeah. And it's just about learning to balance, because you can't have all white space. You can't have no white space. Like, 'cause you turn that page and all it is a block. Like, go open up Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged and you'll see entire pages that are just blocks of paragraph, right? I mean, that's just all it is. And, mm-hmm. and you can feel like, oh, I can't do this. I can't read that. That's so much. So it's learning to have the good balance between all of this.
Right. Yeah. And I guess I would say, so playing devil's advocate a little bit, somebody might say, well, you know, I'm aiming for a reader who is willing to work a little harder and is, you know, is okay with reading a big block of text. And I think that's, it's certainly admirable. And I, you know, I love reading periodically things that really challenge me as a reader, that they're not just, it's not just easy. You have to kind of work at it. But at the same time, what you really want to focus on is the, you know, is the quality of the reading experience, and can the reader get completely lost in what you're doing and have, like, be experiencing the scene rather than feeling like they're reading it. And I would say that, like, that tackling a scene at a time after you've looked at the big structure, obviously, of your novel or of the story, whatever the length, that you look at those individual scenes and make sure that you're weaving. You could even identify, I think this would be a great idea, like a great way to do it is to print it out on, you know, on paper, on real paper, and and then use a different highlighter for dialogue, a different color highlighter for dialogue, and a different color highlighter for description and action, and that you know, then you can kind of see in color the balance, and and then work with it and just, you know, trim it where it needs to be trimmed and add where it needs to be added, and that way you would, you know, and then the other thing is that with practice it gets easier.
That's for sure.
Because you'll get a feel for it.
Right. Reading more, like just getting into your genre more is really good. And it's good that you're playing devil's advocate here, because I want to make sure everyone understands, like, when I approach anything, I'm approaching it from a commercial aspect, like trying to help people make a living out of this. And so that's why I would attack immediately in here the dialogue, because that is going to limit your audience on who's going to be able to pick the book up and stick with it. But if that's the audience you're going for, you know, because there is an audience for this type of dialogue, there's an audience for this type of book, and that's when you're shooting for, then, you know, you have to take a different approach with it. Like you're saying, like, you want to, if you're writing for the challenging audience, then you have to write that way. It's understanding your audience. And I always approach it as the general population audience.
Yeah. And I think whatever you do, as long as you're being intentional about it and it works, then, you know, then by all means, go for it. It's just a matter of, you know, does it work? Can your ideal reader fall into your story and get lost there?
Yeah.
And that's the main thing, whether we're talking about the balance of dialogue and narration and action, or we're talking about verbs, or we're talking about punctuation or whatever, that it's all about, can that reader just fall in to your story and stay there and, you know, kind of escape from their own experience.
Exactly. And that's all you're trying to get. Just be perfect. I mean, there's nothing difficult about that.
Yeah, come on. Like, it's so easy. No. And I will say it is painfully hard for me too. So I don't want anyone to think that I'm like, oh, this is so easy. You know, it's hard. It takes time and effort. It takes time and effort.
I mean, you've spent how long writing the book, and now you're going to spend how long editing the book, you know, to make sure you've got this stuff. And it does feel like, oh, I don't want to do anymore. But if you want, you know, to have it around for a long time, take the effort to make it the best it possibly can be.
Yeah. And when you get frustrated with it, just set it aside for a day or so. And yeah. All right. Did you have anything else you wanted to mention?
No, that's all I had. So good job on doing the omniscient. Keep that up. Yeah. I want to see more of that.
Yeah, I think that really works with this story, because I really liked getting a little taste of the rabbit's experience and what had actually happened, you know, where the rabbit had left right about the time, or the hare, I should say, right about the time when Malachan was forming the thought. That was great. Oh, all right. So speaking of transitions, I have an editorial mission for us. Oh,
perfect.
And it's on smooth transitions. So what I recommend is that you look at the transitions between your scenes to make sure that you are providing that smooth reading experience. Can the reader tell right away where you are, when you are, and who's essentially their guide or the filter through which they are viewing the story or point of view? And make sure, go scene by scene and make sure that you are providing that smooth transition. And a friendly reminder, you can go to writership.com/episodes to sign up for the email list and get those editorial missions directly in your inbox. And so it's a great solution if you're normally listening while on the go and you can't write down the mission. If you're running or cycling, you don't want to, stop and do that, but you can still take advantage of that. So that's a great solution.
Or maybe you're chasing cats out of trees.
Yeah.
Out of
Christmas trees. That happens. It happens. It's real.
It is real. Though I think there's support groups for it too.
So. I hope so.
The Writership Podcast is brought to you by the good folks at the Author Marketing Club, which you can find at www.authormarketingclub.com. Don't forget, when you become a premium member today, you'll gain access to the new and improved Amazon Reviewer Grabber tool.
Okay, if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher. If you want to have your 5 pages reviewed, please visit us at writership.com/submissions. And finally, be sure to check out the Book Editor Show, which Clark hosts with Peter Turley. That's it for episode 87. We'll see you next time on the Writership Podcast.
Ready for Leslie and Clark to help you find the treasure in your manuscript? Submit your pages to writership.org/podcast.